Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXXI, Assassination. Assassination seemed to be a fairly regular occurrence in the right Roman circles, and the gossip around the Senate floor must have frequently turned to who's knifing who. So grab thee a dagger, or a handy nearby table leg, as we discuss this, dare I say it, time-honoured tradition. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Assassination I am taking as the murder of somebody who is well known, which covers almost everybody that we know of from antiquity. But I'm concentrating here particularly on political assassination, which means that it's going to concern Roman leaders.
And not assassination of character, by the way, we should say, when it comes to political machinations.
There's a lot more of that.
Yeah.
There are degrees of this, I suppose. For example, I'm not going to deal here with Cicero, although some people would technically put him into that category, and I can see that being quite viable. Technically, he was proscribed. He was put on a list, which meant that he was available to be killed, that it was legal to kill him. Of course, this is right at the end of the Republic when the definition of what's legal depends on who you are. There are some much clearer cases where there is a plot. Cicero was running away. He knew that they were coming for him. Quite often, the emperor or person involved won't know.
Yeah.
It's a surprise.
Yeah. Okay. So technically that's an execution. So we're not going to be dealing with that. So how far back in Roman history, when you're talking about assassination, does it come up?
You could go right back to the very beginning. It's like they have this tradition of assassination. Livy tells us there is even a rumor that Romulus was assassinated.
Yeah, right.
So he's the founder of the city, the first king. He tells us that it's one version, that Romulus, because he was such a military figure, made himself unpopular with the Senate and they decided to do away with him. But certainly fairly early on, still in Rome's mythical history, one of the early kings, Servius Tullius, was murdered by his own daughter who was trying to promote her husband to be the next king.
Yeah, that's pretty clear cut. This is what happens as a sign of progression.
Servius Tullius may not have existed, or this may not have happened to him. This is undocumented history. But what he represents is what we go on to see in a lot of other assassinations in ancient Rome, which is that Roman myth says that the reason, one of the reasons his daughter wants to kill him is not just that she wants her husband to be king, but that she's annoyed with him for giving away power and property to the people, for not keeping it amongst the elites.
So the myth reflects current status quo.
Exactly, yeah. Which it often does.
Yeah. Okay, so what was the perception of assassination, or how did it get carried out during Republic times then?
In the Republic, there is increasingly assassination is used as a way of getting rid of people who are your political opponent if they're trying to do something radical. Although there are isolated cases before this, but it becomes much more common and the stories are told in a lot more detail in what we call the decline of the Republic, say the last 100 or so years of the Republic. So most people will say that the Republic starts to end, as it were, it's a long, slow death, back in the 2nd century BCE. Okay, and it's not over until, say, 27 BCE when Augustus comes to power. But even 100 years before that, there's the start of the kind of seeds of this discontent, whereby a lot of the poor of Rome, who are citizens, have lost their land. It's been bought up by elites, so they become the landless poor. And still amongst the elites, there is an attempt to redress this balance. And that's where the conflict is, because they're going to have to give away some land to the ordinary people. They're going to have to cancel debts. They're going to have to give more power to the ordinary people and less power to the Senate. Senate doesn't want to lose its power. So that's the basic conflict that gets set up, which leads to warlords coming to power. And engaging in civil war and the Republic ending. But before any of those civil wars, we have people being prominent in trying to help out with the land problem, passing what are often called agrarian bills, who the Senate can't stop, so they assassinate them instead.
Okay. So it's a real clash in ideals here, or a bit of a conservatives against progressives.
Exactly. It's exactly that opposition. It's the people who want to maintain power with the senatorial elite and the people who are usually from that senatorial elite, but start to see that A, this is not just, and B, they can get popularity and power from this base of people who are losing out under the current system.
Mm.
So it's not, they're not necessarily entirely selfless themselves. They're also looking for votes. The progressives nearly always lose in this battle because they're the ones trying to change things. So the earliest, do you want me to go on to the Gracchi here or do you want to ask something?
No, keep going.
The progressives usually lose out in this battle because they're the ones who are trying to change things. So the way of stopping them is assassination. And one of the earliest examples we have of this are these two brothers who are known as the Gracchi, Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus, who are successively what are called tribunes of the plebs, who are meant to represent the plebs. Okay, so 10 years apart, they have this role. They're not the only ones, but they're one of the tribunes in their year. So Tiberius is tribune of the plebs in 133. They try to bring in laws which will redress this balance. So Tiberius Gracchus is from an incredibly aristocratic family, from the Sempronii, who are, you know, they are the top level of Roman society. So he's very prominent. He passes a law redistributing land to the landless poor, the agrarian law. The rich elites hate this. He also advocates for the people and does it by bypassing the Senate. His murder is pretty ignominious, and you can decide whether you would regard this as an assassination or is it just a riot, really. I'm going to read a passage from Plutarch here. There's chaos going on. There's what is termed by Plutarch in chapter 19 of Tiberius's life, a rout. And as Tiberius himself turned to flee, someone laid hold of his garments. So they grab him. So he let his toga go, which is probably a symbolic moment, actually, that he let his toga be torn off and fled in his tunic. But he stumbled and fell to the ground among some bodies that lay in front of him. As he strove to rise to his feet, he received his first blow, as everybody admits, from Publius Saterius, one of his colleagues, so another one of the tribunes, who smote him on the head with the leg of a bench. That's not an honourable way to go, is it?
No.
To the second blow, claim was made by Lucius Rufus, who plumed himself upon it as upon some noble deed. With Plutarch really giving the opinion that it's not a noble deed, I think.
Mm.
And of the rest, more than 300 were killed by blows from sticks and stones, but not one by the sword.
More than 300 people.
Mm. One of many, but he's the important one. He's the figurehead.
Yeah, that, so that sounds like, you know, one hell of a riot, but opportunistic.
Yes. There clearly was a plan to get rid of him. There was talk of getting rid of him, but it actually happened in the middle of a riot. So that's why I say you could claim that this, which is kind of brought forward usually as one of the watershed moments in Roman assassination, particularly between these two opposing camps of what is called the popularis group, the people who want to please the people, want to do what they can for the people, and the best men, the senators, in Latin, the optimates. This is the moment, and this assassination, it often is called, it's usually called an assassination, is an important watershed moment here.
Mm.
But when you read into the detail, I'm not, perhaps some people wouldn't call it an assassination because it's not a carefully crafted plot, really, is it?
Yeah, no, I'd still call it an assassination. They had a motive to do it. They carried it out. But what I'm kind of wondering is, do the senators think so much of the Roman government, of the Republic and its rules and its procedures, that they'd murder somebody? Or do they think so little of somebody being murdered? Was murdering somebody, an assassination, a big event? Was it a serious undertaking? Were there repercussions? Is it something that you don't do lightly? Or was it that the rules of the Roman Republic are so important to uphold that we need to take this drastic step? I'm trying to gauge how important this is.
In a way, we'd need to talk to those senators. They would say these people are threatening the Republic, physically threatening it, so they had to be dealt with. But really, they were threatening it in a political way. They were threatening to make it irrelevant by just going to the people and ignoring the Senate. That's what Tiberius was doing. But there are no repercussions for the murderers of Tiberius. So the people in power do manage to float this as a justifiable killing.
Well, you said a couple of names there, the people who dealt the blows.
And who were proud of it. Yeah.
Who were proud of it and no repercussions.
Indeed, Tiberius's body is treated in the most dishonourable fashion. They do what they do to criminals. They throw his body into the Tiber. And they banished some of the people who managed to survive, who were on Tiberius's side. And this is the most horrible, cruel bit of this description, actually. This is from the next chapter, chapter 20. A certain Gaius Villius they shut up in a cage and then put in vipers and serpents and in this way killed him.
Wow. Okay.
That's nasty even by Roman terms, I think. So your question is a really good one. I'm not sure that I can answer it adequately as to whether the Romans thought this was justified. I think this is a point at which people are becoming so divided that if you were on Tiberius's popularis side, absolutely not justifiable. But if you're on the senatorial side, it's fine.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a bit of a facile comparison, but it's a polarization you can see going on in some modern societies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm definitely looking at this going, okay, history's repeating itself.
You will think it's okay whatever one side does and just not believe anything bad that they might have done or to write it off as justifiable. Because we're kind of not interested in reading the whole story anymore. We'll just think, well, my guy did that, it must be fine.
Yeah, but that also infers that we think differently about assassination than the ancient Romans did, because they assassinated people, that's how things go on there. But if we did that now, I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but if it did happen, it would be a much bigger deal.
Yes, look, this is a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a short-lived victory for the senators. Plutarch is writing about this as something that is fairly vile and wrong. And that's because he lives under the imperial system. And I think that they're looking back at these people who have tried to make changes. He doesn't see the assassination as the right thing to do. I think at the time, he gives us the impression that there was enough power behind the people who wanted the assassination that it was considered okay by enough people who mattered. They should have been brought to justice, Plutarch would probably argue, but they weren't going to be.
So the culmination of all of this must have been right at the end of the Roman Republic. You've got the biggest assassination that we talk about from that time, which is that of Julius Caesar.
Yeah, and that's a much more clear-cut plot. And of course, that's in 44 BCE. But it's not like nothing has happened between Gaius in 123 and Caesar in 44. Pretty much the same pattern has happened in a couple of standout cases along the way. So in 88 BCE, a man called Sulpicius, who's another tribune of the people, was assassinated. Again, trying to redistribute power and wealth to the people. And also just being on Marius's side. The Marius-Sulla conflict is very much along the same lines, with Marius being a popularis. And then in the 50s, in 52 BCE, Caesar's sometime ally, his tribune of the plebs, another tribune of the plebs, Clodius Pulcher, is murdered in kind of mob riot led by the other faction of Pompey's man, who's called Milo. So this is really the culmination of that civil unrest. Rome is falling apart at this point. It's hard to get anybody to be magistrates. And the murder of Clodius, which ends up with the people taking his body to the Senate House and burning it. And the Senate House is burned down. And I think that's a great symbol, it's a horrible thing to happen, of that division. That if you're going to murder people we think are on our side, then we're going to burn your house down.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, Julius Caesar builds a new Senate House and calls it the Julian Senate House, the Julian Curia. It's like he's taken over that whole body.
So the assassination of Julius Caesar is really the last-ditch effort to stop this long trend that's been going on for 100 years.
Absolutely.
But with the previous assassinations that we've talked about and that you mentioned, they seem to be very rushed affairs and very sudden, whereas this one, maybe because he's got such a big military presence around him, takes a long, well-thought-out conspiracy. There was a lot more thought and a lot more support built up against Caesar before he was finally knifed.
Yeah, and he has become the one figurehead that you need to get rid of here because, to put it in context, Caesar has won a civil war by this point. He's defeated Pompey. Pompey is dead. Pompey's allies have either been killed off or forgiven by Caesar. So he really is the one who's in control. And he comes back to Rome in 48 BC, massive quadruple triumph. He wears his triumphal gear a lot more than some people think is technically wise.
That's covering the bald spot, though.
Well, that's also that, yeah. And he really is set up as the one and only power in Rome. And in 46 BC, he becomes permanent dictator, that term, which is not a term that means dictator in the kind of Mussolini way. It does mean somebody who can deal with a crisis. But the word permanent doesn't apply to that. So that's a final tearing apart of republican magistracies.
Yeah. So it sounds like the assassination happened too late.
I guess if you were anti-Caesar and thought that he was potentially on the road to autocracy, he is the sole power and authority in Rome. And the Senate has to defer to him and they're not happy with that. And I think in a way it's almost the more symbolic parts of this that really rub the Senate up the wrong way. So there's a famous story and is told both by Plutarch and Suetonius, but I think a little more fully in Plutarch, is the incident of Mark Antony and the attempt to crown Julius Caesar. So in Plutarch's Life of Caesar, chapter 61, he says, Caesar was seated upon the rostra, it's the speaker's platform, on a golden throne, arrayed in triumphal attire. All right, so he's wearing his triumphal gear, and triumphal gear pretty much makes you close to a god. That's heavily symbolic.
Yeah.
Antony was consul. Accordingly, after the crowd in the forum had made way for him, he carried a diadem, round which a wreath of laurel was tied, and held it out to Caesar. Then there was applause, not loud, but slight and preconcerted. But when Caesar pushed away the diadem, all the people applauded. And when Antony offered it again, few. And when Caesar declined it again, all applauded. So they're much more excited when he turns down the crown and says, no, I don't want to be king. This is supposedly an attempt to win the people over to the idea that Caesar might be becoming a Hellenistic king. And many people see that as the final straw with Caesar. The Senate, or the real diehard Republicans in the Senate, are not going to put up with this kind of behavior anymore, these theatrics going on. Of course, the really significant things that Caesar had done, which had annoyed them in the first place, were very much in line with what had been going on since the Gracchi. It's things like providing debt relief for the people. And so the conspiracy arises.
The Senate is not in control anymore, so plotting an assassination isn't exactly something that can happen out in the open as much as it was previously. So the previous ones that you talked about seem to be very much everyone came to this by consensus. Let's go and kill this guy, whether there's a mob involved or not. I've got a handy table leg. Let's go at him. But with this one, they take their time. It's almost like behind veils and closed doors that this they come up with this.
This is much more of what we would classically call a conspiracy, in that there is a plot. The word you used before about, I think, Tiberius, opportunistic, applies to those earlier assassinations. There is a plan to get rid of this person, but when it happens is very much down to who gets there first with the chair leg.
Yep.
Here, we know that these senators are going to turn up with daggers, and I'm sure everybody knows something of how it happens.
Quickly, who is it with what? In what location? Give us a Cluedo breakdown.
Well, the two most famous ones, of course, are Brutus, Cassius, and around 60 senators plot to kill Caesar where the Senate is meeting, the Theatre of Pompey.
Yeah.
So according to Suetonius, there'd been clearly murmurs of disapproval and little huddles of people forming plots separately for some time. It's when Caesar refuses the crown and when he's made perpetual dictator that this, as Suetonius puts it in chapter 80 of Caesar's life, it was this that led the conspirators to hasten in carrying out their designs in order to avoid giving their assent to this proposal. And the proposal is that Caesar be made a king. Therefore, the plots, which had previously been formed separately, often by groups of two or three, were united into a general conspiracy. In Suetonius' account, we have lots of omens of Caesar's death, which are famously also in Plutarch and then turn up in the play Julius Caesar. The soothsayer Spurinna tells him to beware of danger. And typically for soothsayers and prophets and oracles, does it in an unclear way or slightly unclear way that says the danger wouldn't come later than the Ides of March. So apparently he thinks it's okay to go to this Senate meeting because the Ides of March has arrived. But of course, it's not the end of the Ides of March, so he's not safe. But this is kind of a trope of assassination that's planned, that people will warn you and your wife will try and keep you home, but you'll go anyway. In fact, it's Decimus Brutus who finally persuades him that he would be very disappointing if he didn't turn up.
Yeah.
Because it would, from their point of view. Suetonius tells us that when Caesar sits down, the conspirators gather around him as if they're going to honour him, to pay him their respects. And one of their leaders, a man called Tilius Cimber, comes closer as if he's going to ask him a question. And when Caesar says, with his hand, with some kind of gesture, you know, we'll do this later, Cimber caught his toga by both shoulders. Then as Caesar cried, "Why, this is violence," one of the Cascas, there's two people called Casca, stabbed him from one side just below the throat. Caesar, he fights back a little bit, caught Casca's arm and ran it through with his stylus. But as he tried to get to his feet, he was stopped by another wound. When he saw that he was beset on every side by drawn daggers, he muffled his head in his robe and at the same time drew down its lap to his feet with his left hand in order to fall more decently. Thinking about decency, even in death. And with the lower part of his body also covered. And like this, he was stabbed 23 times.
So there's 60 people involved in this.
Yeah, they don't all stab him.
No. They don't all feel inclined or they don't think it's needed.
Well, I mean, at least one of them is keeping Mark Antony out.
Okay.
Actually waylaying him at the door. And they all run away. Suetonius is quite disgusted by that. All the conspirators run off.
That doesn't surprise me. They're probably very much in shock about that they've actually done this. So in previous assassinations, we've seen a case of, you know, this was justified, this is victory, look at the great thing that we've done for the Roman Republic. Not so in the case of this.
I think they were expecting the same thing to happen.
Yeah.
They apparently had the intention to throw his body into the Tiber and confiscate his property, exactly what had been done with the Gracchi. So they thought it was going to go down in the same way. But it did not. Caesar had a lot more power and a lot more backing from the people. So even though apparently some of the people had turned against him towards the end, he still has a big power base. So they don't get that chance. Caesar is buried properly. Indeed, the Caesarians, they're often called, the people on his side, use his wounds, kind of in the way Opimius had his servant's body. So they take the toga that was on Julius Caesar with all the blood and stab wounds and they put it up on the speaker's platform in the forum so people can see it. So they can see what's happened to Caesar and they use the funeral as this big event.
Yeah, so this is what the Senate has done to the person who was speaking for you.
Yeah, well, the conspirators, I don't think they'd even use the word Senate, but yeah. Okay. They are much more successful at the PR in declaring the assassins to be the enemies of the people rather than the assassinated.
Mm.
So this, I think, is the beginning of us seeing people like Mark Antony and Octavian as well, who's Caesar's heir, being very good at that self-promotion.
Okay.
And promoting themselves through this tragedy of assassination.
All right, so roll on another civil war, and we now have emperors. Is that an okay transition? Yeah. And now assassination takes on an entirely new dimension. It's not about preserving the status quo so much. It's pretty much who's going to be in control.
Yeah, we really don't have these two factions in any meaningful way anymore.
Mm.
While there might be people who hang on to the idea of a return to the Republic, indeed there are, especially amongst the senatorial elite who write things, people like Tacitus, that doesn't happen. I don't think anyone seriously thinks it's going to happen after even the succession of the second emperor. But of course, what the dynastic arrangement means is that you get to nominate your successor and nobody else is getting any say.
Mm.
So the only way to change who's going to be in charge is by killing the incumbent. that is why assassinations come back to haunt the emperors. So unpopular emperors are always vulnerable to this horrible end.
There's a handy list on Wikipedia, a category of Roman emperors who were killed by the Praetorian Guard.
Mm.
And it seems to be if you run foul of the Praetorian Guard, if you don't keep the military on side, mm-hmm. they are going to kill you.
Yeah. And of course, it's that very particular subsection of the military who are meant to protect the emperor, who spend a lot of time with the emperor, who might feel aggrieved against him because of pay, because he treats them like dirt and, you know, doesn't respect them.
Mm.
The head of the Praetorian Guard might himself hope to rise to power. As in a failed conspiracy plot in the reign of Tiberius, when his Praetorian prefect, when Sejanus plots with Tiberius's niece, and the plot will apparently culminate in killing off Tiberius, probably niece's husband as well, so that they can get married and through her connections, he can become emperor.
Mm.
That doesn't usually happen. Usually it's someone else in the family or civil war. There are those kind of aspirations sometimes on the part of the Praetorian Guard. Oh, they get to decide who's the next emperor.
Yes.
So it's kind of a bid for power, usually, or a bid to stop the emperor treating them badly.
Yeah. Okay, so there were a number of emperors that were assassinated, and I guess a number of emperors' family members who were assassinated. And we aren't going to go through all of them because we've done some of them in depth, but let's just take an example. But firstly, who is killed emperor-wise? Who's assassinated?
Well, the first to be killed is Caligula. Yep. And I think we'll have a look at him again in detail because it was so long ago.
Yep.
And also, he's the first.
Not to be outdone by...
There's also Domitian.
Yeah.
I guess his death is quite important in 96 CE because that's the end of a dynasty. And then Commodus. So Caligula is only emperor for 4 short years from 39 to 41. And he is the first emperor to be killed in a plot. Tacitus makes all kinds of little insidious comments about Augustus and Tiberius possibly being killed off by family members. But it's not clear, and there's no plot that's talked about. So this is not the end of a dynasty because his uncle Claudius becomes emperor after him. And something important to bear in mind about that, given that we've talked about the repercussions for the people who do the killing, whether they get away with it or whether they, like Julius Caesar's assassins, have to flee.
Mm.
With Caligula, because his uncle becomes emperor after him, Claudius does not celebrate this. He condemns the conspiracy and he has the conspirators executed.
Mm.
So this is not something that they get away with. He's not going to condone what I have cleverly called emperor-side or regicide, the killing of an emperor. It's really double-sided for the successor. Do they condemn the policies of the predecessor that made them so unpopular that they got killed off and therefore divorce themselves from them and maybe have a damnatio memoriae, remember, wiping out of their memory, which is what happens to Commodus, for example? Or do they say, I'm emperor now, I don't want this to happen to me, I'm not going to condone this sort of behavior, let's go find these people and punish them, let's show them what happens when you kill an emperor?
Septimius Severus does that. He goes after the people who kill Commodus.
He rehabilitates Commodus,
yeah,
doesn't he? So yeah. Even after the fact, even after you've had the damnatio, an emperor can come along and say, well, I'm not happy with this situation, where it's kind of more about the role of emperor being demeaned rather than the individual, I suppose. So the plot is from fairly high echelons. It comes from the Praetorian Guard. Cassius Chaerea is the man's name. And one of the tribunes, Cornelius Sabinus. They are, like many other people, really tired of Caligula's kind of crazy running of the empire. He's not really interested in the running of the empire. He's not interested in the administration. He's interested in entertaining himself.
Hmm.
He doesn't take the Senate and the military seriously. You know, there's that stupid story where he goes on campaign with the army and he gets them to gather up seashells as spoils of war and says he's conquered ocean.
Yeah.
So he's kind of undermining a lot of their rituals and traditions. sticking two fingers up at the Roman constitution and the dignity of Rome in many ways. And the rumors that he's going to make his horse a consul because that would be as good as any of those senators.
Yeah.
So all of these ways that he's demeaning the Republic. And the Praetorian Guard in particular apparently are demeaned by him giving them stupid things to say as the watchword, effeminate sayings or just things that are not manly enough for the military.
What? So the watchword is, I'm wearing women's underwear.
Suetonius in chapter 26 of Caligula says, Cassius Chaerea, tribune of the Praetorian cohort, an older man, he's a very experienced military man, but the emperor used to taunt him by calling him soft and effeminate in the most abusive manner. And when he asked for the watchword, giving him Priapus, who's the god of fertility, or Venus, obscene terms, I suppose. And sometimes when for some reason he gave the emperor thanks, offering his hand to be kissed, then moving it in an obscene gesture. So Cassius Chaerea, who's you can see depicted as this very sober, long time in the military, serious guy, is being treated in this very flippant manner by, I remember, a very young emperor, still in his 20s.
Yeah.
You can see it would get a bit tiresome.
Yeah, he'd just want to smack the young twerp about the head.
Rather than just smack him, they actually stab him.
Maybe with a knife, yeah.
And the scenario for this is that he's at the games and he's eaten too much and leaves to go off and relieve himself, presumably, and they attack him in the corridor, in the tunnel, and stab him. So Chaerea came up behind, gave him a deep cut in the neck, having first cried, "Take that." I must say, it's not one of the grandest statements of this is for liberty or something like that.
Yeah,
that's
it. Just take that.
And then the tribune Cornelius Sabinus, who was the other conspirator, faced Gaius and stabbed him in the breast.
And he hasn't said anything either. You could have thought that Suetonius at least could give them a good line.
Well, that is Suetonius, chapter 58. Yeah. And he does carry on. I think that he thinks this is not quite enough. Others say that Sabinus, after getting rid of the crowds through centurions who were in the plot, asked for the watchword as soldiers do. And that when Gaius gave him Jupiter, he cried, "So be it." And as Gaius looked around, he split his jawbone with a blow of the sword. That's a little more dramatic.
Yes, Gaius being Caligula. Yes.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, he is Gaius Caligula. And then multiple people put their swords into Caligula. Some even thrust their swords through his privates, says Suetonius, okay, in a very chaste kind of translation here. He does get protected. Some of his German bodyguard kill some of the assassins. So this is not a unanimous, we all hate Caligula moment. They also, by accident, kill off some senators who weren't really in on the plot.
Okay.
So they don't take any prisoners.
And Caligula's family. Aftermath of this is what's behind curtain number one, Claudius. And we make him the next emperor. And Claudius has things to say, as you said earlier, about this being not how you treat an emperor. Don't get any ideas. But it seems to me that as a result of that and their action of making Claudius the emperor, that this was nothing about them wanting power themselves. It was that they do not think that Caligula deserves the power. He doesn't deserve to be emperor. He's demeaning the role, and we need somebody who's going to be properly. Caligula doesn't deserve it.
Yeah. They're trying to get rid of Caligula. They have no further plan. Suetonius actually says, the conspirators too had not agreed on a successor.
It's in
chapter 60, right at the end of the life of Caligula. The Senate was so unanimously in favor of reestablishing the Republic that the consuls called the first meeting not in the Senate House, because it had the name Julia, after Julius Caesar, but in the Capitol. But they do it all too late, and the Praetorian Guard have already chosen. Yeah, there's no coherent plot of we want the head of the Praetorian Guard in charge, or we want someone else from the imperial family.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Or we want to have the Republic back. We want this freedom, this glorious golden age that nobody was actually alive in anymore. It does seem like a lashing out. Just let's just get rid of Caligula.
So thinking further ahead then, when Domitian is killed and it goes on to Nerva, that's the Senate making that move and that decision to put Nerva in power. Mm. But at the same time, that wasn't part of the plot to kill Domitian.
No, seemingly not. But they knew by then that they had to act quickly if they wanted their man in charge.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, Nerva isn't popular with the army, so he has to very quickly adopt Trajan. By that point in the late first century, you need to keep both sides happy.
Mm. And even further along, when Commodus gets bumped off, they actually have Pertinax lined up and agreed to ready to
so
take over.
So they're learning, the
they
conspirators.
Are learning. Finally, they are learning. So that one kind of worked out for a little bit.
But say with Nero, say Nero had been murdered, I should say, and it could be part of our little cohort of assassinated emperors.
Yeah.
There's no real plan after that. It's just various army leaders across the empire declaring themselves emperor. So we end up with that year of civil war. That's really chaotic and probably leads to more deaths than any of the other assassinations.
Yeah. Clearly, the further it goes with emperors, it shows if you don't have the military in your camp, you're not going to be effective or stay around for a long time.
Well, it's ironic, isn't it? Because the first person who you could really say has a monarchic ambition is Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
And he has a strong army behind him and one that's just won a war. But he can't bring the Senate on side and doesn't really try. And that's why he's assassinated. And gradually people learn that lesson. So Augustus can balance that out. Caligula fails, and that's why he's the first murdered emperor. But you can see that progression of the army becoming more and more powerful and the Senate becoming less relevant. However, the more successful emperors still achieve that balance between the Senate and the people and the army.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Senior Lecturer in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review, they help us feel appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook and you can follow us on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.